Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken? A podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show.
I'm Kimberly Atkins-Storr, in for Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. 3 months ago today, Russian forces began their invasion of Ukraine. It has been a bloody 3 months. Tens of thousands of Ukrainians and Russians are thought to have been killed. The UN estimates that nearly 4,000 of those were Ukrainian civilians. Cities have been flattened. Over the past 3 months, we at On Point have spoken with several Ukrainians, some still in their homes, some internally displaced, some refugees in nearby neighboring countries, and some who live and work here in the United States and have been watching the war from afar to get a sense of the conflict from their perspective. So this hour, we check in again on some of those Ukrainians as the war with Russia enters its fourth month. First, Ivan Gomza joins me from Kyiv, where we last spoke to him on March 23rd. When we spoke to him on March 23rd, he was internally displaced, living in Lviv at his sister-in-law's house with his wife and young child. He's a professor of political science at Kyiv School of Economics. Ivan, welcome back to On Point.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So what was it like when you arrived in Lviv at the beginning of the war, at the time that you and others were going there? There were buses and trains that were taking people out of the country. Sort of describe to us what life was like in those early days.
Well, the main word is uncertainty, because when we arrived to Lviv, we were not sure whether we should and shall stay there, or maybe we would have to go further to the west. So the first few days were, you know, like unknown. What should our plans be? How should we proceed? Whether we stay at Lviv at all?
And how, in that moment, you said that there was that uncertainty. How were you planning on going there? Did you even have time to plan? What did you think the future would look like from that point?
Well, we didn't really plan for that. I mean, we have relatives in Lviv, so when Russian helicopters started bombing Kyiv, we just took our belongings and we ran. So that's the story.
So when you were last on the show on March 23rd, Meghna asked you what kind of toll the war and the uncertainty of fleeing to another city was taking on you. And this is what you said.
It's like jumping. When you jump, you can fly high. And sometimes during the war, you feel that feeling of high. I mean, it's like, oh, we are winning. Or maybe at least we killed some bastards and so on and so on. And then there are other days when you are going down, you are sinking into despair. You think that how this will go on for months, years. Who knows whether the bomb will fall on you. It's like, you know, oscillation. That is the word. Yes, let's put it that way. It's like emotional oscillation. Mm-hmm. It is between hope and despair.
So now you have returned to Kyiv. What do you think, hearing yourself in March, and how is it different for you now?
So I told that was a correct description of a person on adrenaline. And nowadays, I'm much more serene. First of all, I came back to my own apartment in Kyiv. And second, Russians are no longer in the vicinities. So I would say that today, the feelings are much more flattened. You know, no emotional vacillation, as I put it, no high and low moments in your personal life. Actually, it is not serene, okay, but much more moderate, the emotions, I mean.
So how is Kyiv different now than when you left?
Well, I'm still, you know, exploring. I mean, every time, every day, I'm going in the neighborhood to check which that or that shop is open, has it reopened or no, are there any distractions? Just to give you an example of how it is still abnormal, I have a field, you know, like a field of grass just near my house. And today I went for a walk. And actually, while walking there, I had a nasty thought, maybe there is a booby trap somewhere here. I mean, it's a field I know really well, but Russians, they might have booby trapped it just for fun. And while walking and listening to a music, I was actually paying really close attention to anything underneath.
Mm. So you told my colleague Meghna that you stopped your clock at 5 a.m. the morning of the war. Remind us why you did that, and have you restarted that clock?
Well, actually, yes, I did it. I mean, I restarted it just when I arrived home. I took it from the wall and I restarted it. So the point I was making, 5 a.m. was the time when the war has been declared by Putin in his on-air declaration of war. And it was like a symbol. I mean, I wasn't sure whether the apartment would still be there. I mean, here, maybe it might have been bombed, something like that. So I decided it is a symbolic action. Sometimes, you know, if apartment is destroyed, a wall can still be standing. And then a fire brigade might come and see, you know, the wall and the clock and the hour when everything has been shattered. And now I'm really happy because I came back. Everything is really okay. I mean, the apartment is a little bit dusty, was a little bit dusty. I came 5 days ago, so we cleaned it up. And like the life restarts, and that is why I put correct time. I inserted the battery in the clock, and it is clocking.
Well, Yvonne, I'd like to bring in another voice that we heard from in March. Olga Buzanova is co-founder of the Ukraine Witness Project, which has been keeping a visual record of this war. Olga stayed in the capital of Kyiv even when battles raged on the outskirts of the city and missiles roared in. And she joins us from Kyiv today. Olga, welcome back to On Point.
Hi, and thank you for having me here.
And I want to let our listeners know you can hear, you can find a link to interviews and other videos from the Ukraine Witness Project at our website, onpointradio.org. So, Olga, earlier in the war, you sent your husband and son away and you decided to stay. Why? Remind us of why you stayed and have they returned yet?
I was staying in Kyiv because of my parents, because my father cannot walk and it was impossible to take him out of the city. And also I started participation in this project, Ukrainian Witness, and it was necessary for me to stay. So I sent my children with my husband to the Western Ukraine and they are still there. So I'm they didn't return to Kyiv.
Olga, here you are speaking to my colleague Meghna Chakrabarty on the show on March 23rd, describing what it was like in those days to drive in the city and how people had to navigate around tank traps in the streets.
You have to go slalom because otherwise you cannot pass. And many of the drivers didn't see that and they were just hitting through that because it was in the night. So when within the first week I was driving through the city and I saw like many of the cars. So, well, it's something of a movie, let's say, when you drive through the city, which is without people, nobody in the street, a few cars, and you are driving and you see these cars broken and they are still there because nobody takes them out.
And at the beginning of war, you said that people were really focusing on what was happening. They were consuming every bit of news that they can. We heard some tape from you from the last show. And then things changed. How has life changed in terms of how people are living, the news they're consuming, and how they're getting by?
I think it was part of my speech about the city. It was like without people and it was like left by everybody. And when you are driving along, you see these cars that were not evacuated. So it was like from a kind of a movie. But now the city returns to its ordinary life, I believe. There are many people walking, many cars, and even children in the streets playing. So the life returns back. But as to consuming of the information, really news were the most popular thing within the first week and month of the war. But now it seems like people cannot live in the severe stress for quite a long time, of course, and therefore they need to like relax and have some change and in terms of the information they have, they are getting. Yeah. And therefore what we do, what people do around, they continue, like they are still keeping eye on the news, but they like make a balance a little bit with some other content, maybe some even football or so. So because it is hard to be alerted all the time.
Yeah, yeah. Do you have what you need there in terms of sufficient food, sufficient fuel, and other necessities?
It is everything is okay with the food and the electricity. It is short. It is, well, we have the shortage of fuel because of the war. Actually, it was many of our oil storages were shelled and they were ruined. And we have also the damages on our oil, like the plants where the gasoline is made. And therefore, mm-hmm. we are now running quite out of the fuel, and this is a problem which is being solved by the government within the last 3 weeks, I believe.
And are you still, you talked about going through Easter and having these last few days. You know, I'm going to pause you first, and I'm going to ask you more about what it has been like in the past several months living in Kyiv. We are looking back on the past 3 months as Ukrainians have held off Russian forces, but at a great cost. We'll continue our conversation when we come back. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast.
This is On Point. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. We're speaking today to Ukrainians, taking stock of their experiences in a time of war. My guests are Olga Buzanova, co-founder of the Ukraine Witness Project, and Ivan Gomza, a professor of political science at the Kyiv School of Economics, who spent the last 3 months internally displaced in Lviv. Both are joining me today from Kyiv. And before we get back into the conversation, let's listen to Aleftina Kahidze. She's a visual artist who lives in the village of Muzichi, outside of Kyiv. We last heard from her in late March. Back then, Russian forces were so close, she could feel the explosions in her bones. Her neighbors had fled, and she was feeding their farm animals for them. But in recent weeks, she's been traveling in Europe, presenting her art, giving classes to Ukrainian child refugees, which is now mostly about the war, at art festivals around the continent. Her husband is still back in the village.
At the moment, in the area where my village is no Russians. So it was liberated in the beginning of April, but still we do have spontaneous Russian missiles or rockets. So they could be any day, anywhere.
Now that Russian forces have been pushed back, things are just beginning to get back to normal.
All my neighbors back because the area was liberated. One by one, they all back, and it was really so sweet meetings. They are almost crying, and they said that they helped them to have their nerves okay, because each day I reported that their houses were fine, okay, and for them it was so much important. Otherwise, they would be imagining something crazy and couldn't sleep, they said. So the animals I took care, now the owners do what I did.
As her neighbors returned, they made a grim discovery. The corpses of dead Russian soldiers left behind by their retreating comrades.
All these who were actually killed, they were brought to my village, to the center, to the cafeteria. It was just stuff of Russian soldiers, their personal items, and some items belong them as a soldiers.
And then there were the Ukrainian dead. You'll remember the images of dead civilians in the nearby towns of Bucha and Irpin, face down in the mud, hands tied behind their backs. And Alevtina says they've been bringing those dead to a neighboring town where her friend Alexander has been hard at work at the morgue.
He's actually helping French experts to put those dead people who were on torture or just killed to change the bags, actually plastic bags, and to remove them. And actually, just 1 week ago, he was saying they are still coming and coming and coming. Like each day, they have like 30 bodies. Can you imagine?
In her travels in Europe, Alevtina says she's found people were extremely supportive, but she's also occasionally frustrated at people who'd never experienced war offering her advice about how to manage in a war. She's also been frustrated by Europeans who consider themselves pacifists and who have lectured against war.
I told Austrian and German people who were saying to me about pacifism that it's luxury, because their country are not under attack. This is why they can allow themselves to dream or believe in pacifism.
That was Alevtina Kahidze, a visual artist who lives in a village outside Kyiv. Olga, I want to go back to you. I mentioned that life, as life is in the middle of a war, went on, including holidays. And you said that Easter was different this year. Can you describe that?
Holidays this year are quite different because we have this military state, and therefore we do not have like days off after these holidays. And this is one of the major differences. But actually, this Easter was a different one in terms of the emotional part, because it is quite a family holiday for many of us. And this time it was not for many, it was not with their families, and for many it was not at their homes. So it was different in terms of emotions. And we were also prohibited from going to church actually for the nights it was banned to go outside within the night hours, and it wasn't allowed also within the Easter.
So I want to bring in one more voice into the conversation now, Mariana Bujarin, joins us from Boston. She's a research associate at the Harvard Kennedy School Belfer Center's Project on Managing the Atom, an author of the forthcoming Inheriting the Bomb, The Collapse of the USSR and the Nuclear Disarmament of Ukraine. Mariana previously joined us the day after the war began. Mariana, welcome back to On Point.
Hi, Kimberly.
So when was it that you last visited Ukraine, and remind us of where you were as the war was starting?
So I was in Ukraine the second week of February. I'm from western city of Lviv. My mom still lives there and some other family. It wasn't a planned trip. My mom was going through a surgery and I flew out on a short notice to be there with her just as the U.S. Embassy was evacuating all of its diplomatic personnel. And it was very strange and interesting in a perverse sense for me as a social scientist to be in a country that's on the verge of a war. I left on February 16th, I had a planned trip to a vacation with my kids to Ecuador, actually. And I was in an Amazonian jungle on February 24th. As Russian troops rolled in, I stayed up all night on the one spot that had the internet to follow the developments on my phone. On the Telegram channels that I follow. Yeah. And it was really quite surreal.
And it must have been just watching not only your home country being invaded, but also seeing the people pull together in such an incredible way, in a way that surprised lots of people throughout the world. What was that like?
Well, absolutely. I think perhaps it wasn't as surprising to us Ukrainians who have had that experience of coming together through consecutive, mass protests, the Orange Revolution, the Revolution of Dignity. But this kind of scope of civic spirit, as it were, in the very early days of the war, that and it's still continuing to today, is really quite incredible and impressive. And as many other people I talked to, and also your guests here in the program, the first reaction was really a shock and this adrenaline rush. Right, you have the fight or flight, and everyone sort of, in their own way, decided to fight. So you choose the way you can contribute best, whether it's with money or with your skill set. For me, it was, taking every engagement I could that came my way to comment on these events, media engagements, conferences, everything, contribute my expertise in every way I can. But there's only so far you can run on this adrenaline, actually, as one of you guests said, because then comes the crash and the exhaustion and these images, they mount, the gore, the stories that roll, that you observe even, from afar. And you can only imagine how it is for people on the ground, the rapes, the mass killings, stories from your friends. A friend of mine nearly escaped from Bucha with two girls, a 10-year-old and 12-year-old daughters, whom she had to cover with a blanket in the footwell of the car because there were reports of, abductions and rapes of young girls. And they were lucky, right? So then comes this exhaustion and this crash and despair. And as Olga described, sort of the third stage perhaps is this normalization, right? This plateauing, this way of trying to find a way to cope long term with the situation of war.
Yeah. Ivan, Russia is planning on a prolonged war and keep going until the resolve on the part of the EU and the US and the Ukrainians diminish. Do you think that the Ukrainian people will be able to have the endurance that it will take, especially given everything that they've been through for the past 3 months?
Well, as a political scientist with a penchant to historical events, so I love history. There is nothing special in victories of small nations against bigger nations. I mean, Afghanistan, it was able to extricate, or actually to make Russian get out of their country, and the United States have a bitter experience of Vietnamese people who, although less powerful, actually made Americans go out. So what I'm trying to say is that, yes, I think that the people of Ukraine, despite the destitution which might be coming, despite the losses including the clothes people. We will overcome. There is nothing which is left. I mean, in case Ukraine loses, it will be a tragedy, and because
Olga, since things are getting more back to normal, it could never be quite normal, but things are getting more back to normal in Kyiv. Do you worry that people might forget what people in the eastern part of the country are going through? I don't know if we have Olga there, but I'll ask Mariana the same question. Do you worry that the relative normality in Kyiv will overshadow what's still happening in other parts of the country?
I think the normalization here is meant more, you know, at least for myself and people I talk to, is just haven't found the coping mechanisms to go on enduring and fighting this fight. So yes, there's perhaps a danger or threat of kind of war fatigue and thinking, all right, and we'll do anything to make this horror end. But I see less of that than rather, you know, people settle in their routines of this is the way I can contribute and this is the way I can keep myself up physically and psychologically in order to be useful to this fight. So, you know, I don't think, at least on the part of Ukrainians, there will be this complacency with the horror of what's going on in the East. I worry more about you know, Western partners and the support of which have been so crucial to Ukraine and to the future success of Ukraine. We see now sort of calls for trying to end this in a diplomatic settlement, which are very understandable. But there is also kind of this fear that I sense of actually letting Ukraine win, right? And this doubt that that's even possible.
And Ivan, you know, some of this is an information war as well. And Ukrainians are also battling a Russian propaganda machine, both in Ukraine and in Russia. How is that part of the war? How is that part of the war going?
Well, actually, you never know. I mean, the fog of war, it also extends to the informational domain. So what we have to do is to consume information from different sources, to weigh it. And sometimes I read Russian news as well, not news, but actually like analytics. Sometimes, very often actually, I read the United Kingdom Special Service briefs, American as well. So actually the war of information is the part of the general warfare. It is used to, you know, make people despair, to lose their morale. And you will never know the truth until the war finished.
And Olga, what do you think about the Russian propaganda machine, and especially given your work with the Ukraine Witness Project? Do you still think that the information that needs to get to the people of Ukraine and even Russia have a chance of getting there?
Yes, for sure. Our project actually was conceived as one to keep the information. We are doing documentaries around the events that now occur in Ukraine. And the reasons why we decided to do that is that we actually, when the war started in 2014, we are all concentrated on fighting back and less on keeping the content, keeping the information about what happened. And that allowed Russians to use their propaganda against us. So now what we do is we make documentaries about the facts around us, about the military activities, about civil life, about the problems that arise and how we overcome them. And we think it is very useful for our people for our descendants in future, and both for those who are now looking at Ukraine and looking at the problems like Ukrainians themselves, because this is the way how you fight in informational war.
And Mariana, we've heard President Biden and others say what's happening, what the Russians are doing are war crimes. Do you have any hope that Russian officials will be tried for war crimes? And why is that important?
There's always hope. You hope there's justice in this world, right? The only way I can see this happening after the Ukrainian war, the Slobodan Milosevic scenario, right? When the Russian people themselves decide that they need a different regime and they would turn someone like Vladimir Putin to some kind of international authorities, international courts. As long as Russian regime remains intact, there could be condemnation, there could be, you know, hope to get him to justice and try him for international crimes. But that's not a certainty.
We are listening to perspectives of Ukrainians as the war with Russia enters its fourth month. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Storr. This is On Point.
This episode is brought to you by ShipStation. If you run an e-commerce business, you know how much work it takes to produce something great while dealing with complicated shipping issues. That's why over 130,000 companies have turned to ShipStation, an innovative tool that allows you to focus less on shipping and more on building your brand. With ShipStation, you can manage orders, label printing, reporting, and customer service on one easy-to-use dashboard. You'll reduce warehouse costs with reliable enterprise solutions and save thousands on shipping costs with discounts up to 89% off. Plus, you can effortlessly import orders from everywhere you sell online. So, turn your shipping challenges into opportunities for growth. Go to ShipStation.com and use code POD to sign up for your free 60-day trial. That's ShipStation.com, code POD.
This is On Point. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Storr. We're checking in with three Ukrainians who were guests on this show early in the war to find out how they're doing and what they think comes next as this war seems set to drag on. My guests are Olga Buzanova and Ivan Gomza, who are joining us from Kyiv, and Mariana Bujarin, who is joining us from Boston. Mariana, I want to ask you what you think about the support Ukrainians have received from America and other Western nations. Has it been enough? Is it more than you expected, or is it not enough?
It has certainly been unprecedented, and I just want to impress how much appreciated it is by, you know, I'm sure the Ukrainian government and authorities, but also by the Ukrainians worldwide. The response has been overwhelming. The bipartisan support in a Congress that can hardly agree on many other things has been very heartening. And, you know, the United States government took a very strong position on the issue and an unwavering support. And we've seen, you know, countries such as Germany to make such a drastic change in their foreign policy and attitude towards supporting Ukraine militarily. So all of that is extremely important to Ukrainian successes on the battlefield. But part of me wonders if there perhaps isn't, you know, more of a kind of reactive attitude. So the West rather reacts rather than takes initiative and plans certain steps or several steps ahead to think what kind of this theory of victory might look like. So instead of just fulfilling Ukrainian demands for more military assistance, for more arms, can we perhaps think several steps ahead of how to take the initiative into our hands instead of being always on the back foot?
So I want to play some sound from NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg last week when he was speaking to top NATO diplomats who had
gathered in Berlin.
Russia's war in Ukraine is not going as Moscow had planned. They failed to take Kiev. They are pulling back from around Kharkiv. Their major offensive in Donbas has stalled. Russia is not achieving its strategic objectives. Ukraine can win this war.
Ivan, do you agree with that? Do you agree that Ukraine can win this war? And what does winning look like?
Well, I absolutely agree with the statement by Stoltenberg. And to understand the end game and the subsequent winning victory, we must remember that each war, any war and every war, is finished with negotiations and a settlement, post-war settlement. And for Ukraine, this post-war settlement, it must contain three important points. First, territorial losses are being taken back, so the territories of Ukraine under occupation are given back. Second, infrastructural damage is being repaid by Russia, at least partially. And third, some meaningful and viable mechanisms which will prevent Russia from repeating the attack, the assault they organized against Ukraine's sovereignty must be created and inbuilt in the future system of the international relations in Europe.
And so you're saying when it comes to that first point, the territorial loss, that do you think that there is any room for compromise there, that there could be some regions that perhaps are under Russian control? Or does success only look like Ukraine being returned to its original borders?
Well, you rarely are willing to trade your territory. I mean, ask yourself as an American citizen, are you willing to trade Alaska for any understanding with the Russia? Or let's put it in different perspective. Are you willing to trade San Francisco, Seattle to make China less more satisfied with American politics? I'm sure you are not. Sometimes, actually, states, they do trade territory at the part of concession. And it is not a point to ponder over just now, because any territorial concessions are contingent upon actually the results of the war. I mean, in case Russia occupies Zaporizhia, Mykolaiv, and Odessa, and it is the worst case scenario, then we can actually try to settle the issue of Crimea to get those territories back. But if the war continues as it is going right now, I mean, Russia is still trying to capture Donbas. They are not able to do it. That's what Stoltenberg told us when he said that their operation is stolen. So if Russia is not able to achieve any strategic dominance, then when I say no territorial losses, this means including Donbas, including Lugansk, Donetsk, and even Crimea.
A Kyiv independent poll found that 82% of Ukrainians believe Ukraine should not give up territory for peace, according to a poll by the Kyiv International Sociology Institute. Only 10% of Ukrainians say Ukraine can give up some of its territories to achieve peace and preserve its independence. So it seems that most of the Ukrainian people agree with you, Ivan. Olga, I want to ask you, what do you want a post-war Ukraine to look like? Both you and the people who you've talked to as part of the Witness Project, what does success look like on the ground to you and the citizens of Ukraine?
Well, actually, what we are thinking of is peace, but we understand that Russia, in its current state, would be like a very dangerous neighbor for quite a long time. So what Ivan told right now, like the negotiations after the war and real enforcement tools to make Ukraine get some defense in terms of international grounds is a very important thing, because without guarantees, there is no way that it would be like a very long-term peace.
And Mariana, I want to talk again about U.S. support. Republican Senator Bill Hagerty was one of 11 Republicans who voted against a $40 billion aid package for Ukraine that passed into law last week. Here he was on Fox News explaining why he didn't support the bill.
I'll be a no on the package. We've got crises erupting across the nation in my home state. We've got to look at our own national security first. Senator Paula said, I certainly don't have anything against the Ukrainians. We want to see them win. But pumping more aid into that country when we're not taking care of our own country, the best thing that Biden could do is stop the war that he's waged on American industry. That would lower prices overall. That would take the funding away from Putin's war machine against Ukraine. It would make our economy do better here. Biden will not do that. Yeah. Biden will not be serious. And so he just wants to throw another $40 billion of American money into this.
Mariana, how do you feel hearing Hagerty and other people make the case against giving more aid to Ukraine?
Well, as a social scientist, and it's hard for me to separate, you know, my personal and my professional view on this. In a sense, it's understandable. Of course, states, when they formulate foreign policy, they have to balance all sorts of, you know, domestic demands on that same budget, on that same money. So on the one hand, yes, I can see how, you know, there's a section of people, there's a selection of people and politicians that would say, well, why, you know, Ukraine is so far away and, you know, why pour all this aid into this country, as, you know, Neville Chamberlain once said, a country far away that we know very little about. And he said that about the Czechoslovakia at the time. But, you know, the other side of that is, you know, it's not just about Ukraine. It's not about the fate of just that one state. It's about security in Europe writ large. And security in Europe writ large has been U.S. focus and U.S. foreign policy priority since the end of the Second World War, right? And, you know, a lot of resources have been poured into that through the Cold War. So in comparison to that, you know, $40 billion is actually not a ton of money.
Yvonne, what do you make of some countries like India either supporting Russia or at the very least not supporting Ukraine? Did that come as a surprise to you?
Well, actually, not really, because what India and Narendra Modi, the prime minister of this country, is doing is actually he's playing his own game, and he is a populist leader in the biggest democracy in the world. When I say biggest, I mean the most populous one. And he actually have to cater to his own public, just like the senator on the Fox show did for his American public. And actually, the example of India and its behavior, and also Brazil and its behavior, it brings into a global perspective, it shows us the global dimensions of the Russo-Ukrainian conflict. Because as Mariana said, she reminded us about the Munich Agreement, Neville Chamberlain, Edouard Daladier, who signed it. And then, despite that agreement, the Second World War started. What you are seeing right now, it's actually the conflagration between liberal and illiberal regimes. And India, in this respect, is really, you know, important because it is a democracy, as I said, the biggest one. But it is tilting, and it can join the camp of the liberal camp of China, of Tajikistan, and Russia. So, and that is something I think the American public should really understand. It is not just about an unknown country in the middle of nowhere. It is actually about American interest as well, because America is a country of liberalism. It is a republic which made that values really matter. And if Ukraine loses, then American ideas will receive a mortal blow. Maybe not the last one, but very important.
I want to talk to each of you about your plans moving forward, not just your practical plans, but also how you're preparing yourself mentally
for the road ahead. Olga, I want to start with you. What are your plans moving forward?
Well, the first and foremost is to continue working, to continue with the project, and to continue with the, my the first and the main work in communications. And the second one is to think over some ways to protect my children in terms of the new school year, and the to choose for them the better to the best way to spend the next school year. So this is basically all.
Yeah. Yvonne, what about you? You're back in Kyiv after many months. What does the road ahead look like for you, and how are you preparing?
Well, actually, in a week, I'm starting a new course for my students. I uploaded the materials just several hours ago. So in this respect, as a professional teacher at the university, I have plenty to do. And also, yes, I have articles to edit, to submit to journals. So in professional, with regards to professional occupation, there is plenty to do. And in as a person, yes, I have a baby daughter, almost three years old. As we came back, I re-entered her to the kindergarten. Actually, now she is there in the kindergarten. And you can imagine like a father being separated even for several hours when there is a real threat of aerial bombardment. It is painful, but on the other hand, it is something you have to do. I mean, you cannot miss your life waiting for the war to finish. You have to do both, to survive the war and to continue living.
Mm. Mariana, what about you? What are your plans, and what are your family members who are still in Ukraine? What does the future look like?
Well, in the most immediate future, I'm happy to report that my mom has agreed to come and visit me and my family, my kids here in New England. So I'm looking forward to her arrival, and as a way to get her, give her a break from the incessant air raid sirens and kind of living under this constant anxiety. So she will be here with us at the end of June. My own work on Ukraine's history of Ukraine's nuclear disarmament is unfortunately rather relevant under the circumstances. So I will continue to, to write and to research and to speak on these matters and try and draw attention to just how much nuclear weapons still are unfortunately important in world affairs, and the Ukrainian war, or Russian invasion of Ukraine, rather, has brought them back and center of our attention. And hopefully, I'm hoping we can all collectively make the right conclusions out of it.
And in just a few seconds we have left, Mariana, do you think that Ukraine will be able to rebuild and maybe even emerge as a more modern nation?
I know things might get harder before they get better, but I have this unwavering faith that in the end, the world will emerge better than it was, and that Ukraine will be rebuilt, and we will prevail.
Mariana Bujarin is a research associate at Harvard Kennedy School's Belfer Center's Project on Managing the Atom. Mariana, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Olga Buzanova is co-founder of the Ukraine Witness Project. Olga, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
And Ivan Gomza is a professor of political science at the Kyiv School of Economics. Ivan, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices. And they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons. And there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.